Good morning, or afternoon, whatever time zone I'm in, sorry.
Oh, hi, Jim.
Yes, sorry, I've been kind of running around.
I'm sure you run around all the time.
Well, thanks, I got that off the, hopefully I don't screw anything up and, you know.
Don't worry, don't let me know.
Yeah, I know, make everybody sure.
I'm gonna start.
Yes, start.
Let me grab a glass of water or something.
Feel like a, good afternoon, my name is David Van Colsbeck. I'm with MGM Resorts International, I'm in a division called MGM Hospitality. And, but I've been in marketing and sales all my life and branding. And previously was Starwood before I came here. And I ran into Rabbi Goodman one day and So here I am, all of a sudden, hey, you're a marketing sales guy, we need some marketing and sales. So he threw a couple ideas by me, and it's actually very intriguing. Just to get everything straight, I am a goy, and I don't, I'm probably the only guy here speaking of those terms, but that's okay. I still believe in the Torah, and that it's the inspired word of God, even though maybe about 61 books short or something like that, give or take. So, but what I'd like to talk about is you know, conservative Judaism, the movement as a brand, and that's what Rabbi asked me. What I'd like to do, and actually it was kind of fun for me because this is something that I've never done before. Obviously, I don't have a presentation off the shelf that a rabbinical speech is not in my library. But I have given it a good deal of thought, and you know, I have a bunch of Jewish friends, so it's good. I can bounce stuff off of them as well. But please, my intention here is to challenge you to sort of think a little bit differently. It's not to offend anybody, so forgive my ignorance up front because I'm not, you know, well versed in the Jewish faith. I'm just kind of, but you can think of me as that outsider looking in, trying to figure out what's going on. What I wanted to do is start out with MGM Grand, because I think there's a lot of parallels between MGM Grand and maybe what you might be doing here, even though it's a 5,000 room Las Vegas casino. It had a lot of legacy issues, and we did a lot of rebranding there. And if I take you through that process, and I'm going to try to apply it to a faith. The first thing I'd like to do, there you go. If I hear anybody snoring. Well, you know, you're an Apple guy, that's a great thing. I was just at a networking conference in San Francisco last week, and I was the only guy in the room that wasn't banging away on a computer during the speech and throwing up comments and stuff while the speaker was actually speaking. It was this crazy thing going on here. The Marriott's not upon it, did you know that?
The next room has the same.
Oh, really? Oh, okay, I see. So they're like, hey, wait a minute. Okay, well, let's really mess it up. I don't know if anyone's a football fan, but Vince Lombardi, one of the greatest football coaches of all time, used to start every spring practice with, gentlemen, this is a football. So you got to start with the basics. You can't really talk about brands until we really understand what a brand is, or at least what I'm talking about in terms of brands. And the two brands, the one brand that I really like to talk about is Harley Davidson. I own a Harley Davidson, I'm a motorcycle guy. And, you know, the beauty about Harley Davidson is I'm one of the dopes that probably spent $5,000 or $6,000 more for my Harley Davidson than I would for a Honda or a Yamaha that would be comparable to that. And why did I do that? What, because it's such a great engineered bike that it doesn't vibrate, it's such a clean ride,
You like the German
evolution. That's right. What is it? Well, it's absolutely not any of those things, and I absolutely know that that's not the case. It's not a performance bike, it can't even come close to a Honda. So why do I buy a Harley? Well, I'm a middle-aged man, I got two kids, I live in suburbia America, right? Go to work every day, wear a coat and tie, do the whole thing. But when I ride around in my neighborhood on my Harley Davidson, what am I? Come on.
You're a rebel.
No, I am a badass. I am a badass, right? Every guy in my neighborhood's going, right? So we're, you know, it's what it is. It's an extension of me, and it's not so much about the bike. It's about what it says about me and about my worldview, right? It says a lot about the Harley Davidson, but take other brands that maybe someone's more familiar with, Volvo and Mercedes. Everybody kind of gets that sort of picture in their mind when you think of Volvo, right? Really safe, well built, boxy. Wouldn't drive it to go pick up chicks or something like that, but you know, it's just a great car. It's a soccer mom car kind of thing, right? Mercedes, very different. Still very well-made car, well-engineered, but a little bit more prestigious, right? It makes a statement, hey, I'm either on my way up or I've made it. You know, I deserve this. This is the kind of car for me. Another one that'll be even more emotional, believe it or not, is Robitussin. Now you don't think of that, but two young kids, you know, one kid gets sick, 30 minutes later the other one gets sick because they can't keep their hands off of each other. So my wife sends me to the store to go get some cough medicine. Well, I'm looking at the Robitussin and I'm looking at Save-On or Osco or Walgreens or whatever it is, and I look at the labels, it's the same exact content, same everything. What do I pick?
Robitussin.
Yeah, and it's $2 more. Why? Well, first of all, I don't want to hear it at home. When what are you doing, trying to get chintzy with your kids? But it's also, I trust that. I go, you know, I'm not so sure. And quite frankly, I'm in marketing. So there's a 98% chance that Robitussin actually made the cough syrup that went into the bottle for Save-On. But it's that 2%, I'm like, I got two kids. You know, I only get one chance with these kids. I'm not going to screw that up. So I buy the Robitussin. You know, so that's truly, you know, that's what brands really resonate. So I'm trying to get to, they're not really stuff, they're emotions, right? It's how people cognize them, how they take it into their heart. And I'm gonna get into that in a little bit more detail. Sorry, I'm having trouble with my clicker here. So a brand is a promise made and kept between our customers. And I would challenge you to think of, and your congregation, right? Your fellowship of believers, whatever you call them. How customers, employees, members, and competitors think about us, but more importantly, what they feel about us, right? And then it's really everything we say and do every day. And think about that. And it's even more important now, because in today's world, everyone's got a video phone, everyone can take pictures, everyone puts stuff up. My kids got a big fight because my one son did something stupid, the other son took a picture of it with his iPhone and stuck it on his Facebook within 30 seconds. And they got a big fight, take it down, do all that kind of stuff. But it's out there for the whole world to see in a matter of seconds. You know, so that's why you have to be so cognizant of what your brand image is and what you're doing with your brand. And what I tell my hotel employees, we're in the service industry. So as much stuff as we have, we've got 28 restaurants, 22 bars, 3 theaters, you know, 4 nightclubs, a 17,000 seat arena, but our brand is really about our people. Because that's where the people forge the relationship. That creates the experience. That's truly the extension of what your brand is. And I would challenge you to say, okay, who's your brand? It's the people in your, you know, kahilot. Did I say that right? How did I do that? Not bad for a goy, huh? In your kahilot. You know, they are the extension of your brand. I'm going to just do this manually since this thing doesn't seem to be cooperating here. So let's talk about what a brand is not. Brand is not a logo or a tagline. It's not really a name. Okay? You got to be very careful with that. A brand is not a name. A brand is an understanding what that name projects, but it's not really the name. So people think, okay, some organizations, some companies need to change their name. Philip Morris needed to change their name. That didn't change their brand, right? So because they didn't want their stock price to be dragged down by all the cancer stuff and all that kind of stuff. They do cigarettes, but they also own Kraft. They own a bunch of other stuff, right? So, you know, just because you change your name doesn't mean you change your brand. It's not something that only affects advertising, and it's not something that's only the marketing department's responsibility. That's probably good news for you, since you probably don't have a marketing department in any of your synagogues or congregations, right? So that's a good thing. So what do successful brands do? Successful brands evoke positive feelings. I pulled Disney up there. Everyone has a wonderful moment, a wonderful memory about Disney, whether it's as a child with the Walt Disney Hour, I'm old enough to remember that, whether it's, you know, that hug by Mickey Mouse at Disneyland, whether it's the time you spent with your kids or your grandkids or whatever it is, there's always a special moment there with Disney. There's Coca-Cola. It's easily recognized. Coca-Cola, I can drink a Coke or Diet Coke anywhere in the world. They know exactly what I'm getting. Everyone knows what I'm saying, no matter what the language they're speaking. Diet Coke means something. They're well-defined. McDonald's. McDonald's is very well-defined. You know what they do? I don't particularly care to eat there. I don't care for that. My kids love it. But everyone in the world knows what McDonald's does. They do burgers, fries, milkshakes, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And also really successful brands have authenticity. Southwest Airlines, the most authentic. They Song Airlines, TED, both went under because they tried to copy it. They just couldn't. Southwest is the real deal. They're the only guys that can pull that off. It's not in Delta's DNA to run a discount airline. So here's my commercial statement, because, you know, why do we do it? Why do we do it? Because it drives stock price. It drives value to our shareholders. You don't have the luxury of counting your brand success that way, but I'm going to give you an opportunity to take a look at different ways that you can look at how your brand can truly be successful for you. Oh, sure. This is where I usually get the CFO's attention, right? Where'd you get that? How'd you do that? So it truly is an investment. And you talk about what?
How do you find brand equity?
Well, look at Coca-Cola, right? Pure brand equity. There's nothing there. They've got they do have distribution with their bottlers, but they're separating the Coca-Cola brand from their bottlers. If Coke doesn't have their brand, what do they got? Colored sugar, fizzy water, right? That's it. And taste tests have shown people can't tell it. You know, blindfold, you can't tell, right? Some people can't tell the difference between 7-Up and Coke in a blindfold. No, seriously, in a blindfold thing, it's amazing. You do all those beer things, you know, the Budweiser versus, you know, Low Life beer, whatever it would be. No one can tell the difference on a blind taste testing. Nobody. So, you know, there is huge brand equity out there. Just real quickly, why do customers choose a hotel? They don't choose it because of the cool rooms. They don't choose it because of the number of restaurants. They don't choose it because of the number of bars. They choose it because of reputation or buzz. So people distill concepts down in their mind so they can kind of get around it, right? So there's not just a huge load of facts associated with everything that they do. So they'll take a brand and they'll say, oh, okay, that's a brand for me, or that's not a brand for me, and they'll categorize it as good, bad, whatever. So the key drivers are reputation and buzz and being entertained. People come to Las Vegas to be entertained. Way down the line is novelty and theme. Well, that's kind of bad news for some of the, you know, for the Paris, the Caesars, the Luxor. You know, they're all grappling today to get rid of the novelty and themes, right? But, you know, for the Luxor, and we own that, kind of hard to take a pointy pyramid and make it a square. So, you know, they're kind of stuck with it. You know, you're stuck with the rooms like that.
In Paris, they can't tear down the Eiffel Tower. So, you know, there's certain elements of it that you're just stuck with on that. So why is this important? Well, in MGM, when I got there, 2002, aside from the fact that it was right after 9/11, we were basically the Wizard of Oz. We were Dorothy and Toto. Then we decided, you know what, this whole kids thing and theme parks in the back and Wizard of Oz and all that, we don't want kids anymore. We want to be an adult playground. Las Vegas doesn't want kids. We don't want strollers and all that. We want people at the gaming, distraction from the gaming machines and blah, blah, blah. So we're going to get rid of that. So we decided that, okay, well, we'll be Hollywood, right? We're going to be all about Bogart and all about the, we're going to tie ourselves closer to the studios, which happen to be owned by Kirk Kerkorian, both of us. So at the time it was a little bit easier. That's not the case anymore. But, so, okay, now we're Hollywood. But then, you know, the Hollywood thing just didn't resonate with people. That's not what they were coming to see. They were going to Hollywood to see Hollywood. They were coming to Las Vegas for something very different. So what is that that we needed to be, right? So what we did is we asked, what do our customers want? Well, we conducted research. The ideal Las Vegas stay and versus what MGM Grand's reputation was and what sort of MGM brought to the game in terms of that ideal Las Vegas stay. Now, we didn't just do research going down the street asking people, what do you want from Las Vegas, right? You kind of had the back door, because if you ask me, back to my Harley, if you ask me, you know, what is it about your Harley that you really love? I said, well, you know, I got the tricked out paint, I got this great chrome package, I got a Screaming Eagle carburetor, I got a, you know, really tricked out seat, the whole thing. I describe it to you, right? But that's not why I bought it. That's not the whole, it fulfills me as a male kind of thing, right? I'm not gonna just admit that to you. So the kind of research that we do is we take a board and we take like 50 pictures and we put them on the board. And they won't be pictures of rooms or restaurants, they'll be pictures of people, they'll be pictures of shoes, or they'll be pictures of musical instruments. Now this is really interesting. So we say, pick out the musical instrument that reminds you most of MGM Grand. Okay, it doesn't really matter what instrument they pick, right? All that matters is, well, why did you pick that? And they'll say, well, I picked the electric guitar because it's high energy, because it's a, you know, it's a party, you know, it's loud, it's noisy, it's irreverent, it's, so you get all these emotional elements that you never get. You say, what do you like about MGM Grand? Oh, I like the pool. You know, yeah, duh, it's 7 acres big. I mean, who doesn't like the pool? We got a river going through it, for goodness sakes. So, you know, that's the whole thing. So, but then you start to understand the whole emotional context of your brand. So it's kind of this backdoor sort of research that we do. So what we found is that Las Vegas, people come to Las Vegas for those sort of emotional reasons, escape, fulfillment, happiness, indulgence, energy, the energy of Las Vegas, right? And they come to MGM Grand for escape, feeling special, indulgence, and energy. Hey, what do you know? A lot of the very same reasons they come to Las Vegas, that's what MGM Grand embodies. Now, the choice, the linear choice here is, okay, I decide to go to Vegas first, and then I decide where I'm gonna stay. So he said, okay, well, how does that apply? So the new MGM Grand had to be based on sort of the melding of two. Like, how do we, you're coming to Vegas, okay, cool. Where are you gonna stay? Well, why should you stay with us? So what we heard was, you know, on the escape side, it's not like Hollywood. You're part of the glitz. We're part of the whole scene. I get to play in the movie. About feeling special. Everyone wants to feel special. Everyone knows that the person pulling up in a Toyota Corolla is probably not going to get treated at the same level of special as somebody pulling up in a Rolls-Royce Phantom, right? But regardless of that, people still want to feel special, like they themselves are special and welcome. Indulgence. And this isn't the, you know, Charlie Sheen indulgence, right, that you read about in the paper. This is people, just take it a little step further, right? People order a bottle of wine for dinner instead of having a glass. Women will wear those spiked heel shoes that they got on sale for some reason that they can't possibly wear back home without getting in a lot of grief. They can wear it in Vegas, right? Nothing naughty, just a little step beyond what you would normally do back home. And then the energy and buzz. People said MGM Grand is Las Vegas within itself, and that really tripped a fuse. So when we say Las Vegas would be the ultimate adult fantasy playground, and then you match that with MGM Grand, the ultimate Vegas experience, you get MGM Grand, Maximum Vegas. And that was our new brand position, Maximum Vegas. And I'm gonna play you a little video that sort of shows you the before and after of the evolution of MGM Grand. You can't really see that, can you? Thank you. Well, believe it or not, I used it to, I used it to the travel industry, to travel agents and that kind of stuff to sort of explain our transition from the old stuffy, fuddy-duddy, or Wizard of Oz stuff and into the new sort of Maximum Vegas MGM brand. I also did, when I talk about employees of the brand, I truly meant that. I did 47 presentations of 9,000 employees in MGM brand. So I did 47 presentations to every single employee, some at 3 a.m, you got the graveyard shift, you got all different kinds of shifts, days, and all that kind of stuff. But showing them, because you can't just change your name. You can't just wake up one morning and say, okay, I'm gonna be cool, right? It doesn't work that way. In fact, I went through this and we did employee advertising. We actually did advertising in the back of the house. We did all this employee immersion stuff before we ever ran our first ad on Maximum Vegas. Because people, they're the ones delivering the brand, right? They gotta understand what they're supposed to deliver. You can't just say, hey, be cool today. Okay, yeah, let's go, everyone be cool today, So you really have to go through the whole process. It's pretty involved and pretty arduous, but definitely worth it if you do it right. TI, or Treasure Island, did it completely the wrong way. They woke up one day, said, you know what, we don't like Treasure Island, we don't want to be pirates anymore. So they took down all the pirate stuff, changed the name to TI instead of Treasure Island, and all their employees are walking around like, the same people, same customers, same everything. I was going with all the pirate stuff. It just doesn't resonate. You have to transition it properly.
So you have to lie and even though.
We don't own TI anymore, so we're bad mom. We don't own TI anymore, so we're bad mom.
So the transition, the training happened before the transition, your presentation.
Yeah. Well, the training happened consistent or at the same time. As the transition is happening, because we were building restaurants, we're doing the whole thing, but ultimately when we went out with Maximum Vegas, we didn't touch Maximum Vegas until every employee actually knew what they were supposed to deliver, the key elements of indulgence and feeling special and welcome. And then we'd go into what that meant for each employee group, because there's some people that never see a customer, there's others that see them all the time, desk or housekeeping or whatnot.
Can you give some examples of that, actually, how you convey the message to a few different departments?
Sure. We actually did ads in the back with like maids and stuff like that. So I make guests feel special by addressing them by name every day, smiling, being friendly, leaving a rose or a flower petal on their a little note on their pillow. Whatever that would be, just little special stuff that people go, oh, well, that's really nice, Because normally, just making the bed, right, that's what they're supposed to do, right? But someone leaves a little personal note, even if it's in Spanish, doesn't matter. It's just a special thing that someone went out of the way to do that. And those are the types of things that actually went into each one of the departments and challenged them to say, how are you going to make a guest feel special? Right? Let's see here. So, why was this right for MGM Grand? Well, it was an ownable position. No other property in Las Vegas could say they were Maximum Vegas like we could say. And we did the research on all the other properties as well, all of our competition. So you gotta be able to own it. It's what our customers believed, and it's what we could deliver. And that's the key thing. You can't just make up something that you wanna be when you can't deliver on it, because customers get it. I mean, they're not stupid. They go, yeah, Maximum Vegas is the same old, this is Dorothy Wizard of Oz, same old crap, just call it something different. I don't know. Wow.
How long did it take to do this?
The course of the rebranding, well, branding is always it's a constant thing. It's a constant evolution, but the going from this portion of it took about a year. And then,
walk us through, let's pretend this is MGM Grand, a religious institution.
Uh-huh.
Fuddy Duddy religious institution. Uh-huh. What would go through your mind in the process to rebrand?
I'm still glad you asked that, because I'm going to get to that. It's going to be a few slides, but I'm going to get to that. So this is just kind of some of the advertising that came out of it just for giggles. They're probably not watching cool stuff like this in the other room, so. But remember, this is a casino, not a fuddy-duddy religious organization, so.
They all want casinos.
Yeah. So.
How do you reach middle age or younger person?
Well, you'll find that you segment your markets, right? So you choose your communication channels. There are certain, you know, this is our website. So even our website brings in the total experience of what MGM is all about, right? So we don't have a normal website. You can stop this website and book it in one of these venues. But you sort of see it through the eyes of somebody. We're not focusing on the stuff, we're just focusing on all the experiences of the stuff. The power of why. Well, I'll ask a couple questions. Why is it that some companies tend to defy the odds? Why are they doing so much better than anybody else? Why is Apple so innovative? And Dell and HP and all those just have that sort of fuddy-duddy sort of thing, sort of functional kind of deal with it, right? Oh, it's a computer. Why did Martin Luther King end up leading the civil rights movement? What was special about him? Well, you'll find it's amazingly simple that the great inspirational leaders and the great companies, they think, they act, and they communicate in a very simple way, in one direction. And it's the complete opposite of what everybody else does. So, and it's all about the why. Everyone knows what we do, right? I think I have a... Everybody knows...
You gotta figure out this.
Everybody knows basically what we do. I'm in the casino business, I build computers, I hold services on Saturday, or if you're a Christian, you hold them on Sunday. I do sorts of things. Everyone basically knows how we do it, right? How do I build a computer? How do I manufacture it? What's my value-added proposition? Why do I do it better than somebody else? Or how do I do it better than somebody else? What's that little element that makes me, differentiates me from somebody else? Very few companies know why they do something. And I'll give you an example with Dell. And if Michael Dell's rabbi is here, please don't tell him I'm busting on his company. But here's the way Dell communicates. They talk about the what. They're outside in, right? They say, hey, we make computers. They're beautifully designed. They're simple to use. They're user-friendly. Want to buy one? Yeah, whatever, right? Here's how Apple thinks. They're from the inside out. They focus on the why. Everything we do, we believe in challenging the status quo. We believe in thinking differently. The way we challenge the status quo is by making our products beautifully designed, simple to use, and user-friendly. And by the way, we happen to make computers. Want to buy one? In other words, want to join my cause? Now, you say, well, that's kind of, I don't quite get it. Well, I'll tell you right now, you're not going to see people camping out for 24 hours in front of the Dell computer store waiting for the next version of their computer. You got that at Apple every day. And it just amazes me, because here's why. People don't buy what you do. They buy why you do it. People don't buy what you do. They buy why you do it. And if you don't know why you do what you do, how do you expect people to buy into it? People don't buy what you do. They buy why you do it. And I'll tell you, the proof of this is actually biological, not psychological, biological. Your neocortex, that's the external part of your brain, it tells us what we do. It's responsible for all the rational thinking, all the analysis, all of our thoughts, and it's the only part of our brain that has a capacity for language. The limbic sections tell us about our feelings that include trust and loyalty. It's where all of our behavior and all of our decisions are made, in the limbic region of the brain. It has no capacity for language. Okay, so in the neocortex, we're able to absorb amazing amounts of information, analyze and crunch up the whole thing. It's the limbic part of our brain that's the why. That's the part that makes all the decisions. And I'll give you a little example of that. You've ever been there where I'm sitting there, God, I got all the information, I understand what's going on, but in my gut, it's just not right. I can't come to grips with it. It's your limbic region telling you, making the decision, but it has no capacity for language, so it can't really explain why. But it's overriding the rational components of your brain. Okay, so back to Bob's point, how do we apply this to a religious movement or a community of believers? Well, let me beat up on the Christians first, since I can take care of myself. if I look at sort of the Christian religion as a whole, I say, what's the what? Well, it's very much like Judaism, only probably some different terminology. We go to church, you go to synagogue. We have weddings, we have funerals, community service, confirmation is kind of our bar mitzvah, counseling, and schools. I go to Faith Lutheran School, or Faith Lutheran here in Las Vegas. We have up from pre-kindergarten all the way up through high school. So, you know, we know the what, we know the how. How? Well, through Jesus, through missions, through biblical teaching, education, prayer, fellowship, and then the why. Okay, why do we do that? Well, why we do it is to save your soul from eternal damnation and to provide you a pathway to go to spend paradise, eternal paradise, with your God. You know, and that I put justification, sanctification, glorification there. Justified from your sins, saved from eternal damnation, sanctified, becoming a good person here on earth to be more like God, and then glorification when you die, go to heaven. Pretty simple. Now, just like in Judaism, there's a lot of takes on this, right? There's 100 and some denominations of Protestantism. Catholicism is primarily Roman Catholic, but there's a number of other sub-segments. And there's two main differences. One are the outside working in denominations, which I'll call the mainline churches. They kind of like, we want to do good, right? So they concentrate on works, on the what aspect of it, and then they work in. Then there's the inside out churches. I call them evangelicals. They're faith-based. They go, we want to be good. And being good will manifest good works from us. Okay? It's a very subtle distinction, but it's very powerful. The reason it's powerful is, look who's growing. All the outside-in churches are down double digits in their denomination. All the inside-outs are up double, triple, quadruple. Now, Church of Christ, I think that's a small denomination, so that's probably a little extraordinary. But Southern Baptist Convention, that's the single largest Protestant denomination there is. A 45% increase from them, that's a lot of people. That's a lot of people. So they're hitting the why. It's the people are searching for the why. So, the conservative movement. What do we have here? Now, this is where, please, no one take any offense. This is just my, you know, my goy look at the world. But, you know, when I look at the what, very similar, you know, synagogue, weddings, funerals, schools, bar mitzvahs, counseling, Israel. And then the how, God, your language, the Hebrew language, Torah, education, prayer. Okay. So then what's the why? I don't know what the why is. You know, if you're looking for an answer, but I just kind of throw in some suggestions there. Understand the world and my life in the context of God, good and evil. Connection to a greater divine cause. We often get, when people come into our church, they're often searching for something. They're searching for a higher meaning or an elevated meaning in life, something that only God can give them. They're disappointed, maybe they're going through some turmoil. I mean, you guys have seen all that before. You're much better versed than I am, but you know, someone's always looking for that higher meaning. How do you give that to me? Nurture my spiritual and character growth. I ran into a wonderful man, Rabbi Gilbert Collin, and he bushwhacked me out front. Great guy. I sat down with him, had a wonderful chat with him for about 20 minutes, and he said, well, but why? You know, one of the suggestions he had is, how do I make God smile today? Beautiful. I love that. But until you really know, until you get that why, how are you going to get people to follow you? Now, you talk about differentiators, and I'm definitely not going to get into that whole thing, but in my mind, there's, from what I can see, there's the big three, right? There's Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform. And what are the whys? When you look at where you are in the world, what you represent to your constituents, your congregation, your, you know, your fellowship group of fellows. What is that? And how are you differentiated from everybody else? Because I from what I understand, there's some concern that conservatives are getting just pulled at from both sides. The Reform's coming in and getting more conservative, and the Orthodox is pulling from the other side. So you have to clearly define your place in the world. And I'll give you some examples of that. So there's this thing, I'm all about perception, right? And perception is reality. Whether we like it or not, perception is reality. So in commerce, we look at what's called a perceptual map. And here's a perceptual map of our brands based on a bunch of other hospitality products, right? And the real key here is sort of the axes. So dormitory versus destination. Dormitory means I'm just going to sell you a room. I don't care what you do. You know, I can get this for you, David. I can give you a copy or give me your email and I'll PDF it for you. But a dormitory is just, I'm just going to sleep here, but I'm going to go to eat somewhere else. I'm going to go have a drink or socialize or whatever somewhere else outside the hotel. A destination is like MGM Grand. We want to keep everybody there, right? We want you to sleep there, we want you to eat there, we want you to swim there, we want you to exercise, we want you to party, we want you to do all kinds of things. So, and then luxury versus non-luxury. But those aren't just the ones. You can go wow versus predictable, right? How much surprise am I going to have? How much surprise do I want in the guest stay? Or traditional versus innovative, right? And you can see where, and quite frankly, it's not exactly where you put the dots on the map. It's the thought process you go through when you're thinking about your organization relative to everything else, relative to your constituents, relative to what else is out there. And I always like to put cars or retail in the boxes just to kind of give it a little sense of people relate a lot to car models. They relate a lot to sort of retail stores or it's kind of fashion brands and that kind of thing. So, you know, I put in luxury, non-luxury, dusty, fresh. Right? Who's old? Who's new? You know, you got Saks, Kmart, Target, and Tommy Bahamas. So kind of stick those in there with it just to kind of give it a little bit of relevance. So then you look for opportunity space. Now, as I told Rabbi Gill, I go, it's kind of tough for you guys, because I can go, okay, well, I'm going to be whatever I want to be, right? I'm going to meet my customer needs. I'm going to do this and that. You guys have a little bit more baggage. You know, you can't change the Ten Commandments and go, well, you know, we don't like that. We don't like that adultery thing where that's out. And, you know, honor thy father, yes, sometimes, you know, something like that. So you're a little bit more constrained, but I think you've got a lot more to work with than you really think you do. And then, so what's your perception? And it's really have some fun with the axes. And plot your congregation. Where do you stand? Are you fun? Are you engaging? Are you dusty? Are you useful? You know, what do you represent? You know, do you have, we have, at my church, we have three services every Sunday morning. Two of them have a 6-7-piece rock band. And the other one's more traditional, the choir and the whole thing. So they're trying to sort of tap in, depending on, you know, how do you target people? Well, you target them, and quite frankly, the choir one, guess when that is? 8 o'clock in the morning when all the old people are up, right? Sorry. And, you know, and so when the youthful people are coming in, you know, they're at 9:30 and 11 o'clock. So.
Sure, so it's interesting, so you're talking about your church. That makes a lot of sense in terms of their model, but when the gentleman behind me asked about brand for the hotel, for Frenchman brand, the advertising looks like it would play to a younger, more lively crowd. That's my reaction. Look at that. So,
yes.
So what do you just target that demographic?
Well,
or do you have other angles that you try to play to bring in other people and cast a wider net?
I didn't bring the full spectrum of ads. I just picked some. I'm not really that young, but I'm young at heart, right? Vegas is a very young town, or young at heart town. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of people over 50 years old walking around the streets here, but they're all acting like teenagers, right? So there's a little bit of that, but if you'll see, like, I have a signature product, which is, they're branded Three Towers in back. There's no casino in them. They're detached from MGM Grand, but they're still on our property. And they're a big hit with what I would call seniors, or the 55 and over crowd. The ones that want to party a little bit, but they don't want to be right in the eye of the hurricane, right? They want to be able to kind of go and just quiet, peaceful. It's a typical lobby like you see here. No casino, no exchange, all that kind of stuff. And my ads to them have older people in it. It's a more sedate sort of message, not as, you know,
sensory.
Yeah, we'll feel it in the morning. Wait a minute, it is morning. You know, that type of thing. It's more, you know, hey, have a great time, have a wonderful dinner, the best wines, the best shows, the best this, without the whole nightclub, you know, partying in the whole thing. But do my ads have a energetic hint to them, tilt to them? Yes, absolutely, because that's my brand. I'm the energy brand. If you want to go to sleep and, you know, just rack out, go to the Four Seasons, because it's nice and quiet up there. There's no casino, great service, comfortable beds, but that's a dormitory. I'm not, if you go back, but if you notice, I'm not a dormitory. I'm a destination. So you can't try to be all things to all people. I can't. And I know that, you know, you're born into the Jewish faith, so you kind of have to be a lot to a lot of people, a broad spectrum of things. I don't think that's an impossible task to have. It's just you've got to understand the why. Truly understand the why. Yeah.
In terms of how far you can go in rebranding, there's a church in my community, its name is Glad Tidings, it's a mega church. They've just put up a new, three times the size of the last one, sanctuary.
Uh-huh.
And when I went in there, the one thing that fascinated me is that the sanctuary of Glad Tidings has no cross.
Yeah. Same with, I think the largest church in the world is just outside of Chicago. Bill Hayer? Well, it used to be, I don't know. They're mega churches now. And you know, they've got the big video camera. I mean, it's almost like a boxing event, for goodness sakes, you know. And a lot of churches have adapted that way. The Joel Olstein, or Josh Olstein, one of those, he's one of the mega churches. Yeah, quite frankly, he's a very large, growing church. He's definitely an outside-in guy, though. You know, they're all about the works and feeling good about yourself and stuff, not about the same, you know, the justification, sanctification, glorification element. They're not. They may call themselves evangelical, but they're not from a true Christian precept standpoint. You know, and you're going to get a lot of that. But you know what? It'll be the church of the day too. You got to have staying power as well. And I think, quite frankly, you know, you've got God on your side, you know, seriously. And you can't lose that. You can't lose sight of that, for sure. And I think that's got to be part of your why. And you know, I think people appreciate that, because I don't go to synagogue for fun. I don't go to synagogue, period, except for weddings and bar mitzvahs. But I mean, do I go to church for fun? No. Do I have fun at church? Yeah, sometimes. Not all the time, but that's not why I go there. You know, so you gotta be careful. There's a careful distinction. I go to church to commune with God. I go to church to, you know, cleanse my soul, to ask forgiveness. That's why I go to church. Now, can I have fun? Can I eat? Can I fellowship? Can I do it? Yeah, absolutely. Do all that stuff. It's cool.
So is church a destination? I guess it's still not too long for
it, but. Pardon?
Is church a destination for you?
Well, the church is a state of mind. I don't, because if you look at, here we go, but I mean, if you look at the Christian view of church, the church is the people, right? It's not the building, it's not all the stuff that's around it. So in my mind, church is a destination from the standpoint that I go to fellowship with my fellow believers, and who believe as I do, and we go to worship, right? So yes, as a destination, as a place to congregate and do that, yeah, absolutely. But if the church burned down tomorrow, we'd still have a church. I mean, if the church building burned down tomorrow, we'd still have a church. Did I answer the question?
Over there.
Pardon?
Camaraderie,
yeah.
Just to be with your people, not to be alone.
Yeah. I mean, fellowship is critical. I think it's critical to whatever you call it, kahilot or whatever you call it, but you know, fellowship with my fellow believers, and actually, I kind of lead into that. Fellowship with my fellow believers is one of the critical components of church. Because I can pray on my own, I can worship on my own, I can sing on my own, I can do a lot of things, I can read my Bible on my own, I can educate, but I can't commune with fellow believers on my own. And, you know, God wants us to do that. That's in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. So, you know, I think that it is in the Old Testament, right? Maybe not be in the Torah, but it'd be in the Old Testament.
Yeah, all that you mentioned before, though, you just can't have fellowship.
Yeah.
All that you mentioned before, can you alone?
Right.
Don't you have fun alone?
Yeah. Well, so yeah, I guess.
You have all the patience for going. It's not because of fellowship.
Well, I think there's a lot of things
you can do.
Yeah, I can have sex alone too, but it's not as fun. So, it's kind of one of those things where there's a lot of things you can do alone, but when you do it with fellow believers and in that sort of environment, I think it's much more meaningful on that side. I can educate myself, but it's not as dynamic as it is when I'm in a group of people. I can ask questions, I can do those sorts of things. So I think it's one of the things I think you got to be very careful of is trying to differentiate yourself on the how and what, because you got to, you know, Reformed, Conservative, Orthodox, they all have synagogues. They've all got the Torah. They've all got education. They've all got prayer. So what makes you distinctly different to your congregations? That's you got to be careful of. And we have the same thing in the Christian church. That's why there's 101, you know, you only have three. We got 100 and something. Because everybody's got a different view on everything. But if you boil it all down, you know, we really all believe in the same thing. It's just how we manifest that belief. Am I making any sense?
Seems to me in your model and in the examples, so you're dealing with an area where there are lots of choices. There has to be a totally different dynamic in let's say, a congregation that serves, it's the only one in the area.
Right.
And so differentiating yourself or meeting the needs of a very diverse group of people who have very different
views. Right. Well, the Mormon church figured that out, right? You just have a parish, it's geographic. Catholic church is the same way. Your parish is basically geographic. You go to the church or temple that geographically you're assigned to, right? You don't really have that choice. And, you know, in the Mormon church, they don't even have priests and all that. The individual congregants are the ones that do the teaching and the services and all that kind of stuff. But, so you really get tight with your fellowship of believers on that because you're all sharing in the service. You're putting it on together. There's no rabbi or priest up there giving a sermon or speaking. So, yeah, I agree. You're competing, for lack of a better term, not just with, you know, Reformed and Orthodox, but with other conservative synagogues, right? People have a choice to go, don't they? So, and same thing with Faith Lutheran. I mean, they can go to a Presbyterian church pretty close. Very few nuances that separate Presbyterians and Lutherans from a true faith standpoint. But you got to have the why, you know, and the why is different for every church. Doesn't confound, you know, the basic Christian precepts or the basic religious precepts. It's just why are we here?
I don't want to sidetrack. Question. One of the things we are struggling with now is the question of whether there should be a national brand.
Right.
As opposed to all these local brands, which sometimes we've done quite well with. Uh-huh. Whether it's many of our congregations are doing very well, they're healthy, and yes, they're sometimes challenged because of money and stuff like that. But right now, part of our fight is over national brand. What's your take on balance between local and national?
When you have a global brand, you need, this happens, let me refer to the hotel business because that's really what I know most about. But like W, anyone know W Hotels?
It's the Westin, right?
No. With Starwood, it was part of Starwood, which is Westin. I launched W.
Yeah,
right. W was the coolest, hippest, coolest hotel made when we first launched it. And that's because it was unique. It was different from everything. And each W was unique. Then we started getting bigger. We started getting global. Well, what do you need? Well, you need brand standards. You need all this kind of stuff because we can't just have people going out and building anything they want and calling it a W. So all of a sudden, you got brand standards and everything. And what they lose, what we lost with W, was the uniqueness, the individuality of the brand. And that's what the brand was. We lost the why. Why? Because we're different. Because we can afford to be ourselves, right? And instead, now we're in this box. And here's a W Hotel. Oh crap! You know, who wants to say that? Yes.
Well, let's take a look at MGM, for example. Your international corporation. Mm-hmm. And the why in Las Vegas may be very different than, let's say, the why in
absolutely.
And that's why the national why, I think the whys work on different levels. There's a national why or an international why, and then there is a local why, and they actually may not even be the same because, you know, the rules, you know, what you're trying to achieve in Vegas, I'm sure, is going to be very different than what you might want to achieve, let's say, in a Middle Eastern country. And that makes it a lot trickier to do because you're working, you can't really have, there has to be a certain commonality among the corporate image so that if you go into an MGM, say, in Dubai or something, you feel, well, gee, this is an MGM, a maximum. But it's not going to be what you see in Vegas where you're trying to achieve something.
Well, great. Maximum Vegas in Abu Dhabi is not going to work, right? It's absolutely not going to work. What we've done is put together what's called a brand essence, right? Which is the essence of your brand. And we're going out internationally with three brands, Bellagio, MGM Grand, and Skylofts. And each one of them has a brand essence. Now, but for each individual product, I write a brand positioning based on the overall MGM Grand brand essence, but infusing the local culture, the local elements of the destination into that brand positioning. It's much harder. That's why Marriott, because, you know, any of those hotel companies that open 250 hotels a year can't do that. It's absolutely impossible. But we're small enough where we can say we can individually tailor a hotel experience that's consistent with our brand essence, but also tailored to the community of the destination that we're in. And I think if you're going to go national, that's what you got to say. This is conservative Judaism, and there are a lot of common beliefs that all of you share, and that's exactly the pot that you should throw everything in. You know, this, but they can't stifle your ability to be individual because every one of you has a different makeup of believers or your congregation. I mean, if you're in a synagogue in Sun City here, I would imagine the needs of that synagogue are very different from those in Henderson someplace where, you know, you got families and kids running around where most everybody in Sun City is at Del Webb, 55 years and older, much older, And they just have different needs, both from a spiritual standpoint, from a fellowship standpoint, from all the how, the what, the everything. I mean, they may drop in the same categories, but it's just a different manifestation of that. Yeah?
We're kind of like, in the branding history, the world kind of changed, and our brand didn't change with the times in some respects. I think, or I can speak locally of my own congregation. As the congregation has aged and people are having fewer children, there are fewer people moving back to the city due to the economy and kids being so mobile with their positions, and people generally don't get rooted. We've been slow to respond to these changes in a whole lot of spheres, and therefore we're kind of like where you were with the image of the Wizard of Oz. That's who we really are.
Well, and I'll just make a note. National organizations are typically slower to respond to local issues than local organizations, right? It's the Congress versus your local school board or something like that. Who's going to act faster? Well, hopefully your local school board, right? So that's what I mean. You have in branding, you have what's called an overarching brand, you know, which would be the national or global universal, you know, conservative brand. And then you have the individual brands underneath it, and they have to be consistent with the beliefs of the global brand, which I don't see much problem since God's pretty much ordained most of that. You can't really mess with it anyways, right? So, you know, I think you know more, just my, please don't take offense, but it seems to me like you know more about what you're not than what you are, and that might be your problem. And that's what I talk to my, and that comes from my Jewish friends. Okay, and I have two Jewish friends that are Reformed and two Jewish friends that are conservative. And they're very, very bright and very involved in the faith. So, and you get them together and it's kind of an interesting conversation. But that's just, don't be that. You can't explain yourself in terms of what you're not. That's the death spiral right there. Okay, so now what? I'm just going to summarize real quick, and then I'm going to give you a little sort of story. Brand is not a website. Brand is not a logo. Brand is not a product. A brand is a promise. It's an expectation, and ultimately an experience. And if you don't define it, this is what I'm saying. If you don't define your brand, somebody else will. And don't think they won't. I bet there's 100 Jewish blogs out there. Each one of them typing away every day about what's wrong, what's right, what happened to them, blah, blah, blah. And it's there for the world to see. It's not containable. And this is one of my favorite. Your brand is what people say about you when you're not in the room. So, and this comes from one of my commercial presentations. The goal is not to sell to people who need what you have. It's to sell to people who believe what you believe. And that's harder. That's why people always say, hey, you need a computer? I've got computers. Want to buy one? But let me tell you why we make computers. And let me see if you're in sync with that. I wouldn't buy anything but an Apple. Now, I'm not one of those guys that's going to camp out for 6 hours just to, when I can walk in 6 days later and just pick one off the shelf. But this Apple computer says as much about me and how I view the world and how I approach things as it does how I compute stuff that's really on the keyboard. And then I'll end with, pardon?
The last
sure.
create a similar belief in others than you already have, right? Which is important, I think, in religion, but also with market leaders, they create that belief in others also.
Right. People follow leaders, and you guys are all leaders. People follow leaders not because they have to, but because they want to, right? And they follow those who lead because they share their beliefs. They do it for themselves, right? This is kind of my final example. Martin Luther King, summer 1963, 250,000 people showed up in the same place at the right time on the right date. There not one invitation was sent out. There was no internet, no Twitter, no Facebook, no nothing. People took buses for 6 hours to come see him. Now, why is that? I mean, he was a great orator, but there were plenty of other orators in the day. He was black, but that 25% of the audience was white. So why did they come to see him? It's because he talked about what he believed, not what the country was doing wrong, not what we needed to do to fix things, but what he believed. So why did people come? For themselves. Because they shared that belief with Martin Luther King. And he did the I Had a Dream speech, probably one of the greatest five speeches of all time. And it was based on two things. One was there are two types of laws. One, the laws of God are from a higher power, and the laws of man. And until those two are reconciled, until the laws of man are consistent with the laws of God, we will never live in a just community, never live in a just environment. And all 250,000 people came there for him? No, they came there for them because they bought into that belief. So, if you talk about what you believe, if you talk about what you believe, you'll attract people who believe what you believe. If you talk about stuff that you do, good luck. I mean, that's why all these 12-point things from Congress and all that, the 2,300-page bill, they're all plans, right? You know, that's why Obama, and I don't mean to bust on Obama, that's why Obama the candidate is so different from Obama the governor. As a candidate, he could dream. It was hope, right? Yes, we can. Hope. Now he's governing, and he's got to have, here's the plan for Syria. Here's the plan for healthcare. Here's the plan for the economy. He's lost his dream, and he's very uncomfortable talking about plans. But now he's governing, he has to. And people don't buy into that. He's an unbelievable leader when he dreams. So, you know, the real reality is Martin Luther King, I had a dream speech, not I had a plan, right? So the only thing I would challenge you to do is you're all going to go home and you're going to go back to, you know, Tucson and New York and Atlanta and whatever. Are you going back with a plan or are you going back with a dream? Thank you.